Welcome back. It's glad to have you here for the 269th installment of the Parish of the Patriots. As always, you know who it is, Grandpa Dan. It's the one and only host for the show. There's no guest hosts. If I can't make it, you just don't get a show. That's how it is. If you get something out of today's show, we pass the plate around. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. It is much appreciated. Every little bit helps. It's a blessing for me, and I really, from the bottom of my heart, I do appreciate it. If you do want to do so, I only offer the ultimate privacy coin, snail mail. Snail mail. I got the snail mail. You can find that address right here on this page, the description page here at Radio Albion for the Parish of the Patriots. If you need help addressing an envelope, ask your elders. They can. It's easier than learning the blockchain. Trust me. You'd be shocked how easy, simple it is. Speaking of, let's look at the listener supporter mailbag. It won't take long this week. Grand Junction, I got you here. No note in there, but I did want to let you know I got it. And as always, I very, very much appreciate it. Shout out to you. And of course, our weekly supporter here, Mr. T. Mr. T coming through once again. GPD, may God bless and keep you same back to all of you. And I do. I really appreciate it. I could end right here and just go launch into the Christian specific segment. The Christian specific segment. We do have a Christian specific segment. I forgot to mention, if you're new, your first time listening, we have a Christian specific segment, a sermon, if you would. That's roughly the halfway point of the show, very roughly. Like I say, I'm very tempted. I'm sitting here today. I'm very tempted just to go straight to the Christian specific segment. Instead of an hour long show, you're getting about a 32 minute. You get a 32 minute long show. You get an intro. Get past the offering plate around, listener supporter mailbag, and you get the Christian specific segment, and I'm done. That's all y'all getting. Don't even know what to talk about. You know, I do the daily national shows, as you know, with varying degrees of success, with varying degrees of listenability on Mondays and Fridays. It's just fun. I've really brought back the theme of Funny Fridays, as I like to call it, where I just kind of have fun poking fun at stuff, finding humor in the topics of the day. I really kind of get in the groove. The problem with this, and I was thinking the other day, I was laying around. By the way, I'm actually, this is kind of a unique show. You may not know it. You can't tell it. I normally record this show over the weekend, and here it is. This is Tuesday, and I'm recording this show right before it's going to go up. You know, that's unique for me. Usually, I have days ahead, and I get show, but due to circumstances I have going on, I'm recording this on the day of. And I was reflecting the other day, and I was thinking, man, you know, of course, we all look forward to the day Sven Longshanks gets out of jail. You know, number one, because he's my friend, you know, he's and the work, this is just a very good person. Every time I read some story from Britain, you know, where somebody who's committed an actual violent, heinous crime and they let him off the hook. You know, there's a story the other day where some guy, you know, was convicted of rape and they came around and said, well, we can't deport him because that would be mean. He might get, like, you know, imprisoned in a foreign country. And I think of our friend Sven Longshanks, who's sitting in jail for, I don't even know what. But anyway, number one reason, I want my friend out of jail, obviously. But on a purely selfish reason, I'm thinking, man, I am so, I need a vacation. I need a break. I do the daily national show. This is extra. Before I did the Friday show with Sven, which was a pleasure and easy to do, and this show, and now I'm doing the Friday show by myself and the Monday show by myself. And, you know, the problem is daily national show kind of sucks all of the stuff that comes out, you know, that normally I would have all of this stuff I could visit about the first part of this show, and it gets sucked out because I wind up using it on the Daily Nationalist. But it's okay. It's okay. We shall soldier on. You know, I was talking about the I was talking about snail mail, the ultimate privacy coin. It really is the ultimate privacy coin. All the hoopla over the blockchain, you know, and all these different cryptocurrencies from course, the number one king coin, as they call it, with Bitcoin, all the way down to the least known shitcoin with some sort of made up, you know, they always have some sort of made up data. Oh, this new shitcoin is going to be the thing, because you see, people will be able to use it to whatever. You know, there's always some far-fetched pitch. Most of them wind up being, of course, some kind of pump and dump scheme. But nonetheless, one of the things that always gets promoted is the idea of privacy. You got these transactions. It's not controlled. You have the independence of blockchain. Don't get me wrong. I'm a crypto supporter to an extent. But the fact remains that you're still going to have to turn it into money. I saw a video one time, you know, and it was a kind of a making light of a video, and it was done by a crypto supporter, but he was still, you know, you should be able to laugh at yourself sort of thing. And this guy's going around to different places, like in this restaurant, you know, he gets done eating and the waitress brings the ticket. And he's like, excuse me, do you take Bitcoin? You got to turn that into money. In a lot of ways, with all the privacy hype and whatnot, cash is still king when it comes to privacy. You do cash transactions. The government hates cash transactions. They do. They hate cash transactions. Cash gets a bad rap. I always hate it. Y'all know I hate it whenever somebody talks about the government. You know, they say something along the lines of the government printing all of this money. When the mainstream media does some news story about government's going to spend another $1 trillion through some other money laundering scheme where everybody's going to line their pockets and nothing gets fixed. And they always run this file footage of all these $100 bills being printed off. The machine is stacking the $100 bills. Demonize cash. Ain't got nothing to do with no money being printed. People are just laundering numbers around on a computer. They defame cash, getting a bad name. Cash transactions. You know, I live in Texas. We have a large, varying Hispanic population. And among the Hispanic population, they use cash. And people bitch about that. I don't understand it. I hear white people bitch about it. They'd be like, man, these Mexicans, they go in the store and they pull out a lot of cash. They always paying in cash. See, I'm smart. I got my card. And I shake my head. They get it. You got to learn from these people. Cash is your friend. And they hate it. There's a reason the government hates cash. I just saw a story this morning. The EU is in the midst of passing a ban on cash, basically. And they always start off, you see where they're going, because they always start off with a number that they think. They do focus groups and studies, and they say, okay, what is the threshold? Because they just come out and said, well, we're banning all cash transactions now. And it was something, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but business transactions, 10,000 is the most you can do in cash. Can't do it no more. Private transactions, $3,000. Or well, not dollars, it's euros. It's something, you know, it's a euro. But anyway, I'm going to say dollars because I'm American, buddy. I'm American. I don't care about your faggy EU currency. $3,000 for personal transactions. And people blindly and obedient go along. It's ridiculous. It's oppressive. They did polls before they passed this. And of course, the vast majority of everybody in Europe doesn't like it. But you live in a democracy. And a part of our values of who we are is they just do whatever the hell they want. And you know what? At the end, you look at this. I wish sometimes, you know, how do I put this? I wish sometimes that white people, my fellow white people, I wish sometimes my fellow white people, I do. I wish sometimes though that white people would take a break from bitching about what the immigrants do, you know, and the fact that I get, you know, you don't want them in your country. I get that. But I do sometimes we should take a break from that and step back and say, maybe there's something we can learn from these people. The EU's passing this deal. You're going to be able to do personal transactions over $3,000 in cash. I don't know what the hell. I guess they're going to, you got to swipe your phone with one another. You know, I people do that to me. They'd be like, you know, I'd be like, you know, trying to peddle something off so I can pay my bill. I had to hawk something, you know, and people be like, do you take this whatever, you know, app on the phone? I'm like, I'm old. I take cash. And they act like you're an alien. What do you mean cash? You just got to have this thing on your phone and we wave our phones at each other and see the money transfers over. What's wrong with you, old man? And they act like they don't know. If you don't do the phone waving thing, they got no idea. How are I supposed to do this? Well, let me explain to you. You get off your ass and you go down to the bank. And either they have these machines there called ATMs. I'm old enough to know what that stands for. Automatic teller machines. Most people are young enough. They don't even know what ATM stands for. I know. It's the automatic teller machine. And you use your sticky little card in there. And that some bitch will spit cash out at you. Greenbacks. And maybe they ain't got that in Europe. I don't know. And if you need more than the automatic teller machine is willing to spit out at you, go inside the bank and interact with other people. And you go in there and say, hey, I got my account here. And I need to draw out this much cash. And after you prove who you are, they give it to you. Then you go buy what you're going to buy. You hand somebody cash. Wait the phone. You don't have this app on your phone. I'm old. Don't expect me to download no damn app on my phone. You show your ass up with cash. The EU's putting this $3,000 limit. I always laugh because they're relying on white people going along with this shit. They do. That's why I started off saying I kind of got sidetracked, but I was able to just maintain that thread of where I was going with it to, so that I was able to reel it back in. It's like reeling. It's like hanging up your fishing line. It's like you hanging up your fishing line. You're trying to drag the log that you hung it up on up to you so you can unhook it without snapping the line. That's how I hold on to that train of thought. Sometimes the fishing line snaps and I lose the damn thing. I wish white people would take a break for a moment from bitching about the immigrants and learn from them. And what I mean by that is, to make my point here, what I mean specifically about that. The EU is going to put this $3,000 limit on personal cash transactions. How the hell is that enforceable? Do you think the immigrants in your country that are doing business, legal or otherwise, you think they're going to sit around? Do you think these people are going to sit around and go, oh my gosh, we can't go over the 3,000? No, they're going to go about business like always. How the hell is the government going to regulate your $3,000 personal transaction? They ain't going to know. They can laugh at this. You're immigrants in your country. The EU, they laugh at that. They ain't going to know that law went into effect because they're still going to do their business in cash. You know who's going to be doing it? You know who's going to grumble about it? And, well, I want to buy this off of you for 3,400 fucking euros. But, you know, the EU has this cash. We got to comply. We got to comply. We got to report it. Figure it out. Look around. You think the immigrants coming into Europe, you think they're going to honor that? No, they're going to blow it off and go, well, white people are going to bend over backwards, grumble about it, and comply like they always do. That's why these laws are intended for. Intended for the rule followers. They're going to sit there and go, oh my gosh, I got to go over. Probably the wrong accent. I'm not very good with my accents. Jawohl, we can't go over the $3,000 limit on the EU. That turned out some sort of mishmash. Anyway. Let's not get hung up on accents. Oh, it's the white people that are going to go around and worry about going over the $3,000 personal limit between personal two people and never ask how the hell is EU going to know anyway. People smart, they wise up. You look at this law. If I was living in Europe and I seen this law in effect, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start hoarding cash. I'm going to hoard the cash before the law goes into effect. People be like, what do you mean? You're not going to be able to do? No, hoard the cash. They're trying to herd you out of it. We've all heard the stories, even here in the U.S. People get debanked, you know, to the extreme. You know, I mean, it's one thing to get kicked off of PayPal, Google Pay, or whatever the hell else. But when they come in and shut your bank account down, you got a big hassle going. You've been debanked. Never mind that the government just a few years ago was going around telling everybody they were very, very concerned about people who were underbanked. They said, we need more black people opening bank accounts because they're doing business in cash. Oh my gosh, we can't have these brown people from south of the border doing business in cash. We got to figure out a way to get these people into the banking system. We need them in the system. They're doing business in cash. People are underbanked, they said. And then they turn around and kick people out of being able to use a bank. But you see, the saving grace from that is you can still operate on cash. These moves to kick cash to the curb, because we know they're not going to stop, and nobody of you in the EU, you know, that $10,000 business and $3,000 personal transaction, that's just the starting point. I always say about the income tax here in the U.S. when they first passed it, why only the very top whatever 10% would even pay it. Everybody else didn't even have to file. That's just for the rich people, and here we are today. That's just their starting point. They're just letting you know that's where they're starting. It'll come on down from there. And eventually, they'll just ban cash altogether. They say, well, it's obsolete. Everybody's used to it. They're acclimated to it. It's funny because we're this freedom of democracy system. And I've watched these videos of people in China, and they're already on this system. You know, and they brag about it. Look, you can just go here. Everything you do, no one carries cash in China. They had that deal with the phone. They waved the phone around. I'd never get along with that because, again, I'm old. I don't want to wave my phone around. I don't think that's nifty. I'd rather pull out some bills. But nevertheless, it's funny because you see this, and they've already got it in China. And people in Europe or people in America, they'll sit there and go, see, those people are already, they hooped in. But it's coming here, and this legislation from the EU proves that. That's what they're moving towards. Now, if you're going to, everybody on the face of the planet is moving to this whole BS where you wave your phone around, cashless society. I'm going to have a lot more confidence in a Chinese cashless society than in the democracy cashless society. I think in China, they're probably going to just leave you alone. And yet we know here in the democracy system, you know where that's going to go. See, that's one step hyper over just kicking you off the bank. Because once they remove cash, it means you literally can't do anything. You wave your phone around, there's nothing there because you're not allowed to have a bank because the government says so. Because you're a wrong thinker. You disagree with the narrative. You don't support enough of our democracy values of who we are. Why, you complained about the latest thing. You refused to wear a mask. You questioned the safety of the vaccines or the righteousness of whatever the latest war the government supports. You see all of these people protesting against the genocide in Gaza. Now imagine all of those people, if there's no cash, all of those people have been kicked out of the bank and they can wave their phones. They can't buy food. Kicked out of the system. That's what they have in mind for everybody. It's ultimate control. I'm telling you, if I was in the EU, I'd be hoarding cash. Look around. You learn from the immigrants because they know how to work under the radar. They're used to that stuff. They understand. You just work amongst yourselves. Yes, this requires a certain amount of community. You go to your neighbor and say, man, I'm going to buy that from you for $4,000 cash. And they look at you and nod their head. They sit there and go, oh my gosh, no, we're not allowed to do that. The government says so. Peel off them green bags and y'all looking around. It's like, yeah, we get it. We know what's up. You just work off the books. You got to do that. That's, if you're in Europe, I'm telling you, it's what it is. You better be hoarding some cash. Get ready. You know they're going to cut that phone off. You wave it around all you want to. Ain't nothing going to happen. It's a funny thing watching the insanity of the collapsing West. It really is, because it's so emotional. I don't know. It's I don't know how else to describe it, but except for like emotional, because it doesn't make any logical sense. You look at the collapsing West and have all these problems, you know, economy. I mean, the whole systems, all these systems. System, we have a system-wide failure. Now, the failures are at different levels. Some parts of the system are still somewhat functioning, and other parts are just collapsed completely, and you have all of this, these real problems. Like, if you or I were in charge of these things, if you or I were in charge of the EU instead of Ursula, I'd be sitting around going, man, we got some problems here. We done let Germany got in deindustrialized. They were the only ones making any money. I'd be going, red alert, red alert. We got to figure something out. I'd be going out there and telling the U.S. to stuff it, and we'd be out there fixing that Nord Stream pipeline because we need that Russian gas. They got all these problems. And they worry, they're running around worrying about what people are thinking. Just think about that. Whether it's the EU or the U.S. or Britain, because it's all the same. You have all of these government systems, you know, by which they wield power. And all of these different systems are failing on a different level. And what are they worried about? They straining at gnats. They worried about people on the internet that disagree with them. We got to crack down on these people on the internet. My gosh, this person actually questioned the narrative. Shut them down. They know. They run around. They're worrying about people on the internet and people that disagree with the narrative. I mean, it's irrelevant. You know, it is. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. And yet, this is what they worry about. They're so paranoid. Instead of trying to, like, oh my gosh, like I say, if I was in their shoes, I'd be like, we got to start fixing some shit. The whole system is heading towards collapse, and that's going to leave us where exactly? The system is what's supporting us. We got to fix this thing. They ain't fixing nothing. They worried about these people on the internet aren't going along with the latest thing. Seriously, it doesn't make any sense when you think about it. It's madness. I mean, really, if I was them, I would be like, man, we don't want to give up our system of control. We need to figure out a way to salvage this thing. They're worried about anybody disagreeing with them. It's just crazy to me. It's like being on a sinking ship. You know, it's like you're on a sinking ship. This ain't taking on water. It's listing hard to starboard, mateys. And this time you better get your ass on a lifeboat. You're going to drown. You're going to be going down with the ship. And they're like, your wife wants to stand there and argue with you because she doesn't like the shoes you brought her to put on. I don't want to wear those shoes on the lifeboat. Then there was that time, remember? I'm still mad at you. Don't come at me with that. Still mad at you because of what you picked out for supper. I'm still mad at you because you disagreed with me on the song the band was playing. Doesn't even make any sense. Get your ass on the lifeboat. And these people just, they straining at gnats. They just sure that this one rando on the internet who's criticizing him and making fun of him, he's just going to bring the whole thing down. Meanwhile, the whole thing is falling down around them. Anyway. Cash is your friend. Cash, I'm telling you, man. Cash is what they hate it because it is the ultimate privacy coin. You're doing business in cash. Got to break yourself of this. I got to go along with every rule they dictate to you. Cash represents independence. And that's why these Western governments, these Western entities, the EU, etc., they're going to crack down on it. They're going to crack down on the cash. You know, they can be doing cash. You know, some of that cash they'd be sending to the Ukraine, coming back into their pockets. They ain't going to crack down on that. That's for sure. Well, we're going to go ahead. We're a little early. We're going to go ahead and get in the Christian-specific segment, mostly because I've run out of things to talk about. I'm surprised I found this much to talk about. But we're going to keep on rolling. Nonetheless, it's going to get better. The Christian specific segment is always better. If you're new, stick for it. Don't sit around and go, I don't want to hear no Jesus stuff. I don't care about it. Give it a listen at least one time. It'll be fun, be entertaining. You might get something out of it, or maybe not. I don't care, whatever. You know what to do. Get in here and fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. I believe one of the facets of being a Christian believer is a certain level of conscientiousness about death. Now, most people, it's just human nature, is to, you want to look away from it. It's always something far off. You don't think about it. You just don't think about it because it's unpleasant. But I believe as believers, we have to be conscientious of death. Now, I'm not talking about how there are people, worldly people, whatnot, who will have like a fascination of death, you know, like an occult sort of thing. You know, they broadcast death and they project and say they're not fearful of death. They might have big Grim Reaper symbology, or perhaps, you know, lots of dark tattoos, or these people that, you know, look all goth or dress themselves. I don't know, maybe nobody does that anymore. I get behind the times. But you know what I'm talking about. People who will be like, they project as though they themselves are obsessed with death, or perhaps they try to project that they're just so hardcore they're not even afraid of dying. And yet most of them, if death comes knocking, they're actually very, very terrified of death. Perhaps their way of dealing with death is to minimize it, to turn death into some sort of cartoon character or a caricature that you can make light of, so it doesn't weigh heavy on you. I was thinking the other day, I was thinking about death and how death personified. To understand, death gets a bad rap. That's, death kind of gets a bad rap. And I was thinking if you personified death, if you turn death into more of a human figure, death's just doing his job. Death is always out there and you're always moving closer to him. You look up, you glance up his way, and when you're young especially, he's way off in the distance. And you say, well, I can ignore him. He's not coming around anytime soon. And we tend to live our whole lives that way, understandably so. Again, you can't just obsess over these things. But every day, you on your journey, you're getting a little bit closer to him. And inevitably, the day will come when you look up, and he's staring you right in the face, reaches out and grabs your arm and says, I got you now. How do you face that? As believers, you know, we're conscientious of death, and it's nothing, there's nothing wrong with your faith. Of course, the unknown is scary. I mean, you're going from what you know, even if what you know is bad, the unknown is a frightening thing, and yet we as believers need to be conscientious of death and ready to accept it, the inevitability of it. For it is we as believers who look forward to a reward. We're looking forward, we know we're going to the unknown and it will be better. It's still frightening because it is the unknown. We know only what we have been told. But we do know is going to be better. We need to be conscientious. We want to be aware of them. I was thinking of death personified. I was thinking of death doing his job. What a crappy job death has. Most people just simply ignore him. They won't even make eye contact. It's not that he's unfriendly. He's just a guy doing his job. Most people, when they get up and the time comes, they finally get to meet him. They've tried to ignore him and not make eye contact. And they tried to delay. And then when they finally meet him, they fight him. He has to put up with you fighting and clawing and scratching and cursing him and everything else. It's worse than working a wagey job at Walmart. I'm talking about working for the public. Death has no choice. He has to work with the public. They fight and cuss and tell him to go away. He's just doing his job. It'd be a frightening thing for those of the world because death represents the loss of everything they've put their faith in. Always remember when the mockers and the scoffers come around and they laugh at you because you put your faith in what is yet to come, while they put their faith in what they put in their hand, and they tell you you're stupid because you're putting your faith in something you don't even know what it's going to look like or if it'll even come up. I'm smarter than you. Look, I've got this. I've got this money in my hand. I've got these material objects. I believe in what I can see and touch and feel. If I can't see and touch and feel them, then it can't be real. For these people, death represents losing everything you ever had. Everything that they put their faith in. Always remember, everything they put their faith in is destined. They're going to lose it. We're assured that none can snatch us out of our Savior's hand. None can snatch us out of God's hands. And yet, they face the inevitability that they're going to lose everything they have. Everything they've put their faith in will be taken from them. It's not a matter of if. It is literally a matter of when. For there's no escaping it. For the worldly or for the wicked, death represents something beyond worse than the IRS coming. Take all your stuff. He has come to extract everything away from you, strip you bare, and take everything you've put your faith in. But it's not so for us. It's not so for the believer, for we do not put our faith in the things of this world. We understand that everything in this world is indeed temporary. That's just going about its business, just doing its job. How much could you make? You know, when you deal with somebody, you go to the store, you deal with a wait staff, you know, at a restaurant, and they've had a really bad day, and you're actually nice to them. You leave them a nice tip or something like that, and you can tell that you actually brightened their day a little bit. As believers, when that time comes, we should hope to maybe brighten death's day a little bit. You know, he shows up. He expects you to start fighting him. Everybody fights him and cusses him and claws and kicks. And he's just trying to do his job. And here you are. You're like, well, when he reaches out, grabs your arm and says, I got you now. We finally meet. And you look at him and says, nice to meet you. I was expecting you. It's a surprise, a pleasant surprise for death. Are you actually somebody here who's not going to cuss me out for doing my job? Death can be a comforter. If you are suffering and in pain or you know, great tribulation, whatever the case may be, death comes and covers you up. Death comes and says, if death comes and wraps his arms around you and says no more, death can be a protector. For once death comes and grabs you with his embrace, the worldly persecute you or your own infirmities or your own illnesses and sicknesses, they cannot harm you anymore. Death wraps his arms around you and says, it's okay now. They can't touch you anymore. You're done suffering. You're not going to be in pain any longer. You're done. Death might wrap his arms around you and whisper in your ear, good job. You made it. You got here. You went through all of that. And you came here. You walked in with your head held high. And you were ready. Your suffering and your pain is done. You might say that sounds kind of silly. Nobody wants to die. But as believers, we do understand the inevitability. Again, we're not talking about being obsessed with it. You know, like I say, there's people that get into like occult stuff and they do all this weird stuff. They're obsessed with skulls. They sit around and talk about, you know, they're obsessed with it, but that's a whole different thing. Nobody's talking about being obsessed with it. But again, as believers, we should be conscientious. Again, death's just standing out there waiting for you to arrive. And the average person, just simply the way they deal with it is they just refuse to look his direction, no matter how far off or how close he is. It's just sort of like, well, if I don't look at him, don't make eye contact, you know? It's like when you wrote death, poor death, he's got it tough, I'm telling you. Death gets treated like the homeless people standing there at the stoplight and you're in your car. And everybody's like, don't make eye contact. Just don't look over there. He might come over here. But of course, in the case of death, it is we who move closer to him. We come closer to him. People choose to just don't make eye contact. Don't look over there. He might notice us. Might think we're going to give him $5 or something. We do notice. We understand, and we should understand what he represents. He's just doing his job. This is his job, and it's a rough job. Of course, everybody's afraid of the unknown. We move to the unknown, and that's what it represents for us, a transition. Now, for the believer, it means the fruition, coming to fruition of that which we have put our hope into, that which is to come. Remember, the worldly who mock you and say you're stupid and silly, you don't even know what you're going to get. I'm going to grab everything I can, and yet they will inevitably lose all they have while we put our faith in what is yet to come. And as we live our lives, we carry that faith out by what we do, how we conduct ourselves, the way we treat other people, all of these things as we work towards that end. Our faith is not empty words or it'll fail us. Our faith is demonstrated and carried out. God only cares about our actions. What do we do? How do we live our lives? The way we conduct ourselves. I was thinking about that. You know, we put our faith. We Christian believers, we talk about, you know, our reward's coming. Our reward's coming in the kingdom of God. You know, we're going to go be with Jesus. You know, Jesus talks about a reward. You know, Jesus talks about my Father has many rooms in his mansion. If it wasn't so, I wouldn't have told you such. And we talk about a reward in the kingdom of God. And you don't know what that looks like. People don't know. You don't know until death comes around and shows it to you. It's like your tour guide. That's part of his job. He brings you in. He's like your tour guide. He's going to show you what's to come. You'll be like, wow, I never imagined. You know? But you think about how things operate, because things in this world can be reflective. You know, there's things in the world and the way the world functions to where we can learn about God and we can come to understand. The lukewarm believer, the believer who's kind of a believer in name only. A bino. You know, they talk about rhinos, Republican in name only. Binos, believers in name only. You don't want to be a bino. You know, the bino, you got to understand that if you look at things in this world, we can learn the things, some of the things of God. For instance, if you read a story about a hero, you know, one of those classic medieval stories, you know, like knights in shining armor, the knight, you know, he gets a reward from the king. To get the reward from the king, the knight has to do something. The knight has to rescue the damsel, the princess. The knight has to slay the dragon or the demon lord. Nobody gives the knight a reward for doing nothing. The knight just lounges around the barracks and refuses to leave. He's not going to receive a reward. The knight receives a reward because he goes out and he slays the dragon. He puts the work in. You're not going to get rewarded just for simply laying around. One of my huge problems with the evangelical type people, they have everything is just basically this attitude. You know, those are waiting around for the rapture. Everything is this attitude, you know, that they're just going to wait for God to do everything for them, like God's his servant. The evangelicals sit around and say, well, how do I want to put this? When you or I, when we say, you know, well, that's in God's hands, we are acknowledging that there are no decisions for us to make here. We don't have control over that. We don't necessarily mean or are trying to imply that God is micromanaging that thing. We are acknowledging that we are powerless against it. These are decisions other people will make. These are things around us that we have no control over. And so thus we say, well, we just leave that in God's hands. But see, for a lot of these evangelical types, they take it a step further. They're like the wicked servant in the parable Jesus told, who simply took what the master gave him to invest, and he just buried it and hid it and then dug it up and handed it back. They wait around. When they say it's in God's hands, it's oftentimes an excuse not to do anything, waiting on the rapture. See, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to demonstrate anything. I don't have to act on anything. I said I believe in Jesus, and now I'm going to wait for the rapture. I'm going to sit around. That's just in God's hands, and yet it is a decision they need to make, but they refuse to make because they don't want to take responsibility for it. This results in inaction. This results in not actually doing anything. And worse yet, when you think about it and how it works out, you're reducing to God in that case, you're basically attempting to give God the role of your servant. You're just waiting for God to handle it. I don't need to do anything. And yet there are decisions that you need to make. There are decisions for you to make here. There are things, there are actions you need to take. You have opportunities to demonstrate your faith, and yet they do nothing and expect a reward in the kingdom of God. Remember, the Lord is just, and everybody is treated fairly. Let's read from Luke chapter 8, and I'm going to read a little more than I normally do. Y'all know I usually like to keep this, you know, what I read very short, because nobody wants to sit here and listen to somebody read and drone on. But to kind of make the point I want to make here, we need to cover a little bit more. We're going to look at Luke chapter 8, verses 5 through, I think we'll take it all the way through 18. This is Jesus speaking, and we're starting off with one of his parables, and it's going to be a parable you're fairly familiar with. Jesus says, "A sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trodden down, and the fowls of the earth devoured it. And some fell upon a rock, and as soon as it was sprung up, it withered away because it lacked moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. And other fell on good ground and sprang up and bare fruit 100-fold. And when he had said these things, he cried, 'He that hath ears to hear, let him hear.' And his disciples asked him, saying, 'What might this parable be?' And he said, 'Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God, but to others in parables, that seeing they might not see, and hearing they might not understand.' Now the parable is this: the seed is the word of God. Those by the wayside are they that hear, then cometh the devil, and taketh away the word out of their hearts, lest they should believe and be saved. They on the rock are they which, when they hear, receive the word with joy, and these have no root. For a while they believe, and in time of temptation they fall away. And that which fell among thorns are they which, when they have heard, go forth, and are choked with cares, and riches, and pleasures of this life, and bring no fruit to perfection. But that on the good ground are they which, in an honest and good heart, having heard the word, keep it, and bring forth fruit with patience. No man, when he hath lighted a candle, covereth it with a vessel, or putteth it under a bed, but setteth it on a candlestick, that they which enter in may see the light. And nothing is secret that shall not be made manifest, neither anything hid that shall not be known and come abroad. Take heed, therefore, how ye hear. For whosoever hath, to him shall be given, and whosoever hath not, from him shall be taken even that which he seemeth to have." There are several things here. Would they talk about the seed bearing fruit? What's another way in which that term, bearing fruit? If you talk about, if you have a project and you put a lot of work in, and when it's done and it works out, you say what? You put all this work in, but at the end of the day, it bore fruit. If you invest in a business, if you put your sweat and you work in a business and the business is successful, you say that all of your efforts bared fruit. You see, when he's talking about bearing fruit, he means is going to result in you doing something. I say that, I know I'm so repetitive on that point, but so much of what I see in the MCC is this laziness, is this, well, all you have to do is just sit around and wait for God to take care of everything, and yet Jesus speaks about bearing fruit. In other words, results of your efforts, implying, and in fact, explicitly telling you that you are going to have to do something. Like I said, nobody receives a reward for doing nothing. What kind of kingdom gives a knight a reward for sitting around? You're waiting for the king to take care of everything. It's not how it works. Another thing that's interesting to me from this parable, and I think is very instructive, he gives us these examples you know, the seed that falls on barren ground, that falls on shallow ground, that falls amongst the thorn. And then finally, at the last, he says, there's the seed that lands on the good ground and bears fruit. I think one of the things that really gets missed out of this parable, which Jesus is informing us of, a reality, you have all of these instances. See, the seed landed on all of these different places, but only that on the good ground is bearing any fruit. If this implies, I believe, this implies that most people aren't going to get it. Most people are going to be either, I mean, you're looking at these examples. So this tells us, I mean, if assuming, we have to do a little assuming here, but you were to think in those days, they were sowing by hand. They didn't have machines like we have now. They're sowing by hand. And you have to assume that an equal amount of seed is being thrown out. And if an equal amount of seed is being thrown out, then you have one part that has fallen by the wayside, the other part upon a rock, the other part upon thorns, and finally that which is on good ground. If this is equal amount of seed that is being parsed out, then that tells us that the vast majority of people aren't going to get it. The vast majority of people are actually going to be in one of those other categories, on the rock and the thorns, on the wayside. Three out of four. If you go ahead and take the parable and parse it down, roughly three out of four people aren't going to get it. Think about that. Three out of four people. Now, you notice a lot of these, they accepted it first. In other words, they say the words. Accept Jesus as my Lord and say, yeah, this sounds good. This is good news of the gospel. Heck yeah. But then the thorns come along and they're more tightened up with the things of this world. Or, you know, they don't have any roots. So as soon as things get rough, this isn't worth the trouble. Three out of four. You're sowing the seed. The Lord sows the seed. The word of God goes out there. But the truth of the matter is, only 25%. Go by this. Only 25% are actually going to hear the word and bear fruit and actually be saved. That's something to think about, isn't it? I say, they always, the MCC basically says, you know, this is for everybody, Christianity for everybody. And it's not. That's for roughly 25% are actually going to get it. You're going to have more than that, but they're in some stage of shallow ground or amongst the thorns, but they might show up to church, or they might tell you, if they filling out a questionnaire, what religion do you follow? They're going to check off Christianity. But the reality, as is told to us through this parable, was roughly 25%. 25%, that's what you're getting. When the kingdom of God comes around, they're roughly 25% of the people, they're actually going to get it. The MCC goes around and tells everybody, oh no, this is the easiest thing in the world. All you got to do is say the words. Say the words. If you say the words, you're saved. Yeah, except what are you going to do when the thorns come up with you? The thorns start choking on your faith, choking out your faith. What are you going to do then? There are going to be times that will be hard. What are you going to do? At what point are you going to bear fruit? In other words, do something besides show up for an hour a week, sit like a lump on a log in a pew and listen to somebody talk and go, yeah, that's very good. But then you go back and live your life like everybody else in the world, expecting a reward. You're not actually even doing anything. You're not changing how you live. You're not working on your attitude and working on spiritually maturing. We understand this. Understand that as a believer, a real practicing believer, practicing your faith, working wherever you're at in that, you know, whether you're at the beginner level or the intermediate level, the advanced, wherever you're at in your faith, always understand, don't be surprised, because you are this minority. If you're only 25% of the people among self-proclaimed believers under those who have received the seed, you ain't even start of it, because now you got to figure in those who are literally of the world. Those, you're surrounded by people who are literally of the world. They don't have any care about that. You got children of the devil running around. You got all these weeds running around. You got all of these other people. You this tiny minority. Don't be surprised when they don't get you, when they don't understand you, when they think you're strange, because you actually are working to mature, to spiritually mature. They say, for what? Why? You got this world stuff. Look, come be choked out in the thorns with us. Don't be surprised. It's always meant to be for a small amount of people. And again, this is taught to us in the Old Testament. This is why it's always so critical to understand the Bible as a whole. The patterns, what it means. A pattern in the Old Testament is always God saves a remnant out. He starts off, you got this whole big pool of people, but then they go doing child sacrifice and chasing after the things of this world, all this wickedness, and God always keeps out a remnant. There's always just a small. He says, I got this small amount of people that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. I got this remnant. I saved out for myself a remnant. That's the pattern. When you read the Old Testament, it's always this pattern. God saves out a remnant of the people. He saves out. Well, the rest of them go by the wayside, but he saves for himself a remnant. And that carries over to what we just read in the book of Luke. You're that 25%. There's that remnant. God saves out the remnant. It's always about culling out all this other trash, and he's saving out a remnant that's actually putting in the effort, that's actually making that effort to live their lives with their eye towards the kingdom of God and being conscientious of the one who's going to take us there. And he waits on our journey, the end of our journey in this life. The pattern of God through the Bible is that he saves out a remnant. That is the whole process from the Old Testament to the New. You know, you see that pattern over and over, and yet people today act like, oh, no, it's not supposed to be that way. Everybody's got to agree with you. Otherwise, you must be wrong. Democracy is our values of who we are. Got to go along with what everybody else is doing. It just, when you get a mindset, we're going to wrap up here, but when you get a mindset of understanding and grasping that as a believer, a real practicing believer, not somebody just talking the talk, but who's putting in the effort to spiritually mature in how you live your life. When you get that mindset and get used to the idea and really wrap your head around the idea that you always got it, always works in a pattern of he saves out a remnant. He's always culling. He saves out a remnant. This will help you too in how you live in this world. When the government comes up with some, you know, latest gibberish, if the government, for instance, just as an illustration, if the government comes out and says, oh, well, we changed our mind, everybody needs to go back to wearing the masks again. And you say, well, I'm not going to do that. The pressure that's put upon people when everybody goes along with this is they look around and they see, well, most people are doing it and I've got to fit in. You see, when you yourself have a mindset, you're used to being the odd guy out. You know, you go in the grocery store without your damn mask and everybody's eyeballing you. How dare you go look at him. He's not fitting in. He's not fitting in with the rest of us. Well, how can he just stand and not fit in with the rest of us? We're used to it. We're used to being the remnant. We walk through that. We're used to everybody side eyeing us. We're used to not following along with everybody else. We're comfortable with the idea. We're the minority. We're the minority of God. We're the minority as the children of God. We're the remnant. See, this strengthens you for those times, which is a part of the trial of your faith as well, that you don't bow the knee to some other, that you're prepared. You're prepared when everybody else going along. Don't be surprised because everybody else going to go along. But you're prepared. See, you have that mindset. You understand. You're supposed to be there. There's nothing wrong with you. You understand this is how God works. Because if you're not prepared for that, you're going to look around and say, man, there must be something wrong with me. I got all these other people looking at me. Everybody else doing this, and I'm not doing that. Hell, I seen this preacher. I went to church and the preacher told me there was something wrong with me because I'm not going along with everybody else. But when you understand that God works on that pattern of a remnant, you understand there's nothing wrong with you. This is how it's supposed to work. We'll wrap up on that note. I hope you enjoyed the whole show today, especially this segment. This is the whole reason I do this show. I really appreciate you stopping by. I hope you'll get a chance to check out all of what we've got up to offer here on Radio Albion through the week. I'll try to be back. The plan is always, I always say to try because you never know what could happen. I'll plan to be back on Friday to wrap up your work week with the Daily Nationalist. Keep the faith. We'll see you next time. I hope to see you here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.